Welcome back to the Environmental Law Monitor. I'm your host, Daniel Pope. This podcast is brought to you by Bracewell LLP's Environment, Lands, and Resources Practice Group, and it's a place for thoughtful conversations. We have conversations ranging from the latest developments to perennial topics like litigation, enforcement, and compliance assurance. We're glad you're spending some time with us today. Welcome back, everyone. I'm excited to be joined today by Stephen Cook, veteran podcast guest and friend of the podcast. Is just totally long overdue. You should have been on here months, if not years ago. Scott Cherbach of Montrose, great friend to our practice group. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day, Scott, and coming on the program with us.
Thank you. It's awesome being here.
So Scott and Stephen are both experts in PFAS, the per and polyfluoroalkyl substances, the forever chemicals that we read about in the news frequently. And then for those of us in the legal world and the technical consulting world, you know, we read about it a little bit more closely in the trade press and in EPA regulations and other initiatives. And for me, as I've read more about PFAS, it seems like they're discussed as forever chemicals in a couple of ways, right? They are persistent in the environment. But then there's also this aura around PFAS that not only do they last forever, the problem is going to last forever. It's not really capable of a technical solution. So I've asked Stephen and Scott to come on the podcast today to talk to us about where PFAS is today, what companies can do, especially in light of some new and emerging technologies to address PFAS and how that changes the game. So welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Stephen, I'm going to throw it to you. It feels like every couple of weeks, I see a new headline about something with PFAS and the state of regulation or new initiatives. Can you give us like a snapshot of where we are today as we approach Halloween in 2024?
Absolutely. This is another one of those environmental stories that starts off with great intentions and new technology. As these molecules were created, they are really good at allowing material to slip by. Or I remember as a kid, Teflon was a big thing when it came out. And Teflon is one of the PFAS chemicals at issue. And so these were incredibly useful molecules. That's why they're so ubiquitous in the product chain. And where we are in the regulatory framework now is EPA is pushing out a number of different regulations. Likewise, you have state governments looking at banning PFAS in various products or the intentional use of PFAS. So you've got those issues going on. And then you have litigation going on about damages from the use of PFAS and it showing up in drinking water and such. The EPA regs are just now starting to put in place specific requirements. Most of the ones that are firmly in place are the reporting obligations under Toxics Release Inventory. Other parts of TSCA have come in testing requirements for certain manufacturers. You're going to be seeing a lot more data about where the various PFAS molecules are located out there in the public domain for parties to use as they might. Additionally, you're starting to see the groundwork has been laid now to start putting limits in drinking water. And ultimately, we'll see it in wastewater permits. So those who have manufacturing facilities that use water, you'll have to worry about not only your use of PFAS, but is PFAS in my incoming water and going through the outtake and such. And because of the ubiquitous nature of this, and one of the big ones is AFFF, which is aqueous fill forming foam.
Advanced firefighting foam, which is also AFFF, but
yes. Well, what's great about stuff, it's really good at what it does. I mean, it's one of those products that works. It puts the fire out. And anyone's had a grease fire or other, you know, some chemical fires, they can be difficult, but it forms that tight layer, starves the fire of oxygen, and boom, it goes out. Department of Defense loves it. They really don't like long-term fires on aircraft carriers. Just not good for business. So that's been used extensively throughout industry to put out these chemical fires. Well, now, because the AFFF, what makes it so good is the PFAS molecules in it. Mm-hmm. Now, what do we do? And so switching over, and what you're starting to see now, because the liability is starting to percolate up and the demand for a cleanup to be required is starting to impact far more than just the traditional, oh, give it to the environmental group. They'll go clean up the soil and I don't have to worry about it. It's affecting business.
We're talking about EPA regulating a handful of compounds, and PFAS is really a huge family. of compounds, right? We talk about it with PFAS, but it's just there are thousands of possible molecular combinations of different substances that fall into that family. And that creates some uncertainty as well. So we're seeing regulatory movement with respect to a handful of those chemicals. What comes next, right? Like, I think that that adds to the uncertainty.
Excellent foreshadowing.
So I would like to take this just a quick step back, and in being the Halloween season, this is the monster in the closet, okay? From a public perspective, most of the public still doesn't know what PFAS is. There hasn't been that level of education or outrage that we've seen in other countries like Australia, where it has driven a lot of action to clean this up. If you ask, I live in Houston, Texas, and if I ask 100 people who are not in the environmental industry, maybe 5 will have heard of PFAS. Folks in different regions, maybe a little bit more. But here in Texas, in the South, no one has heard about it. When the public starts to recognize that these are bioaccumulating compounds, that a human's first exposure to PFAS is in the womb, that we are regulating this to part per trillion levels, which is a millionth of a million, and we don't know what health impacts they cause at what levels, there's going to be a paradigm shift in the environmental response to this material more than I think we're prepared for. So to your point, Stephen, you're right. It's been used for everything, lots of really cool things, but we're just now getting to the precipice of the roller coaster. The other real interesting thing is, to your point, routes of entry, water, obviously contaminated water. And I think the public is a little bit numb to polluted water. We hear about polluted water and no one's really sure what chemicals are in our water. The other angle of PFAS is going to have a massive impact is biosolids. What do I mean? Water goes to a treatment facility. It has PFAS, landfill leachate has PFAS, etc. Those compounds go through into the sludge. And what is that sludge used for? Well, in a lot of cases, it's sent to farmers to be used as fertilizer on the fields. And now we're entering the food chain. So not only are you drinking these compounds, it's now going into the food chain via biosolids. So there's going to be a very interesting dynamic when people start to recognize that they are getting this in their organic food as well as in their water. And once that public knowledge piece goes, there's going to be a very different dynamic with PFAS outside of just the regulatory piece.
So what you're saying is that just if I switch to a cast iron skillet and throw the Teflon in the garbage, I'm not safe from food-based PFAS exposures. So we're at point A. Scott, you're describing some point in the future about where this is going, especially if PFAS captures more attention than it already has in sort of the general public. But obviously, PFAS regulations are starting to affect companies and the choices that they make. What are companies doing today to address those risks? And I guess sort of a flip side of the question, like, well, what are they not doing? Is there sort of conscious avoidance among some people or some entities to avoid the PFAS problem, given that, again, we think of it as an intractable problem?
I think it depends. There are levels of risk the companies are going to have to recognize. One of them is that compliance and regulatory risk. Do you have PFAS in your discharge? Look, publicly owned treatment works are going to regulate PFAS discharges before you think. There's a number of cities in the United States that are already taking steps to ban PFAS discharges to them. Eliminating those issues sooner than later is probably a real good idea. Also eliminating potential sources like AFFF firefighting foam, changing those out before you discharge. So knowing where you have it at your active operation is probably a real good idea if you're forward thinking. If you're already under a cleanup corrective action type of scenario, you might want to also start looking for it to get ahead of it. That's going to be a situation of pay me now or pay me later, and being proactive might make a whole lot of sense. Steve, I don't know about you. I don't know that I would start digging holes and looking for a problem if I didn't have a good reason to know that I had a problem.
this is an interesting aspect of it. In my early days of my career, I used to use the phrase, no sample should be taken before it's time. Yet you waited until you were ready for the answer and going to do something about it. And this brings up one of the technical challenges of PFAS is, okay, say if I want to go find out, that's a hard question in and of itself. How do I do that? You tell me you want to know, go solve the problem. Well, how do I find the problem? I mean, there's challenges when you're trying to measure, is it 6 PFAS molecules that you're looking for? Is it 40, 100, 1,000, 13,000? Which ones am I getting? It's an interesting aspect. These are, if you will, designer chemicals, not to be confused with designer, other things that people may take from time to time. But
I'm not sure that we can say that on this is a family podcast.
That's why I went with the phraseology I did. The designer aspect, we'll talk about a little later, I think, brings up the ability to figure out sources, but it also makes it hard to find because we're just now developing the technology. And Scott, I'd like to throw this back to you about how do you go measure this? How do you go find it?
Well, looking for it, there's 2 compounds that are regulated under CERCLA. There's 6 regulated under the Safe Drinking Water Act, 9 proposed RCRA hazardous constituents, 16 under TRI reporting, right? And then if you look at a 1633 test methodology that was recently approved, there's 40-ish. Then there's thousands of compounds if you do a TOP or TOF analysis. What is PFAS? And all of those, the answer is it depends on your application and what are you looking for, which gets to be real complicated very quickly to your point.
And that starts impacting whether it's transactions or anytime you're dealing with this, you just can't say, okay, no PFAS or such. You have to really pay attention to the testing requirement, what methodology you're using, what equipment are you using? Because frankly, a lot of the testing equipment has PFAS in it. So you've got to, there's already specialized issues. So whether it's in a product spec sheet or in a contract or a cleanup standard, you really need to pay attention to the technical side of just defining what, quote, the PFAS you're looking for is, how you're going to determine that you actually saw it or didn't see it. So that's a level of detail that isn't always present in environmental issues. Some molecules, we know what they are. We know the measuring technology. You don't think about that. But with PFAS, there's so many different ways this goes that you have to pay attention to all those details. And the problem is going to be if you decide what it is in Halloween of this year, well, you know what? It's going to be different come Labor Day of next year. There's going to be new methodologies. More techniques have been created. More molecules may be able to be identified. And so how do you keep your obligations evergreen and consistent with whatever deal you struck earlier on when the world changes on you?
And there's also a lot of interpretation by different agencies. I had a situation with a client, let's just say it was a state west of Houston, and the agency, we had a client with a problem with a bit of a spill, and the agency wanted us to clean the water to non-detect levels for all of the 1633 compounds. My answer was, but isn't that more stringent than your groundwater cleanup standards? And their answer was, do you want to discharge it? So the regulations also are up to interpretation by the various agencies to hold people accountable to different levels, which makes it even more complicated.
Well, let's try to uncomplicate it and get practical. So let's imagine that, Stephen, somebody's taken your advice and they have taken the sample in the fullness of time. As you said, no sample should be taken before it's time. I immediately thought of that song, Turn, Turn, Turn by the Birds. But let's say a company has sort of moved past that. They've detected some or a handful of PFAS in soil or at their facility, maybe following the discharge of AFFF or something like that. What technologies actually can help them remediate that contamination? Or what do the next steps look like for a company like that? Is this just going to be a money pit? Are there new technologies that are coming out there that help companies do that in a cost-effective manner that also meets the objective of the cleanup? And what are those?
That's one of the great questions, because we're early on in this development or these molecules. It's unclear. And I'm going to kick it to Scott here very quickly on this. But, when you find an organic groundwater plume, you pretty much know the technologies. You can do very quick back of the envelope, you know, calculation, get a pretty good estimate of what your costs are. And we're not there yet with PFAS because we're still developing the technologies. And this is going to be one of the great adventures we're going to go on, is how fast do we get to a technology that manages to create a manageable waste that can be dealt with in an environmentally sound manner. Then this becomes a problem that can just be handled, similar to how we took all the air emissions that were just going to atmosphere, gathered them all up, stuck them in flare lines. Now that creates the next order of issues when you do that. So we're still trying to figure out how do we gather them and such. And I think Scott's got some experience with different technologies that provide a little hope that we might be able to get to a reasonable approach to dealing with these molecules.
Really, Steve, to your point, because of the chemical and physical properties of PFAS compounds, traditional soil and groundwater remediation technologies like soil vapor extraction or bioremediation just aren't effective. For water contamination and water plumes, some of the traditional technologies will work to some extent. Things like, you know, activated carbon will remove PFAS from groundwater. Problem becomes, what do you do with the waste? Is there enough carbon on the planet? And then what do you do with that waste material? If you send it to a landfill, what happens? Will it just go to the leachate?
So, Scott, I have to interrupt. Is there a great business opportunity here to go capture all the CO2 and turn it into activated carbon filters and grab the PFAS? Is that where I make the $1 billion?
I love that idea.
I mean, I use with my students that if you capture the ozone in Houston and send it up to the stratosphere to fix the ozone hole, there's your $1 billion saving. So anyway, sorry for the aside, but back to your technologies.
All I was getting to is there are new technologies being developed, regenerable ion exchange resin, foam fractionation. The answer is going to be a combination of different technologies, but we just have to start looking at the problem differently and also recognize this isn't just a few chemical plants like traditional chemical exposure or BTECs under a gas station. This is literally every landfill in the country. It's literally every industrial complex in the country. It's in farmer fields. So it's in 99% of all living things. So how low do we want to clean up to and how many sources do we go after is going to be the real question. Because, Steve, I think this has a little bit of a different cleanup goal than other contaminants have had in the past.
Yeah, you're looking at if you detected it's a problem is where they're setting these numbers, whereas everything else has always had some rational limit that somebody could point to a technology, you knew how to get there. And we're not there yet with PFAS. We were with the early numbers when they had 70 part per trillion as kind of the water criteria, but it wasn't an enforceable limit, but people could get there. Going back to the technology, Scott, I'm going to use my 40-year-old engineering technology, which was post the slide rule error, but not by much. Describing these new technologies, rather than getting to the details of it, at a high level, basically, are these ways to take the PFAS that is at these parts per trillion levels and concentrating it down, able to separate it out from whatever media it's in, whether it's soil, water, or such. And so that you get a much lower volume, but much higher concentration of the PFAS in it. And then that's what you got to deal with as far as disposal or destruction. Is that a fair way to characterize them?
Exactly. The technologies are used to break down the PFAS compounds. And remember, there's a whole family of compounds from 8-chain down to 2-chain PFAS compounds. To be able to mineralize all of these various compounds takes a lot of energy. Technologies like supercritical water oxidation are highly energy intensive. If you consider 7 part per trillion or nanograms per liter, imagine a hay bale the size of Madison Square Garden with 10 needles in it. The ability to destroy all that hay and capture 10 of those needles, energy is not feasible. But be able to take a magnet over the hay bales, pull out the needles, and then focus the energy on those 10 needles, that's where we're focusing right now. And I think that's going to be the solution, is super concentrating the PFAS after removing it from the water to be able to actively destroy it.
I love that analogy, because people wrap your hands around disposing of 10 needles. That's doable. We know how to do that. Put them in drums, whatever. You can stick them in a landfill, may not even need to use the incinerator with the issues that has on the air emissions for the partial, you know, combustion issues and such. So that's really kind of part of the hope here. If you're able to come up with those types of technology and implement them, when you talk about the energy usage of them, so I'm guessing what you're going to do is you're going to have this big, huge wind farm and solar panel farm with a data center on one side and a PFAS treatment system on the other side, using all of its self-contained energy. That's my other billion-dollar idea for the clients today.
Now, some of the other interesting technologies are on the sensing and sensor side. Currently, technologies to analyze for PFAS are utilizing some, you know, HPLC and gas chromatograph, mass spectroscopy. By able to use sensors and quickly identify sources of contamination or the identification of PFAS compounds is also going to be an interesting development, so that folks can have near real-time assessment of, I have a problem here or I don't have a problem here, which is something that's real exciting in the PFAS world.
You can see whether it's municipalities and the wastewater treatment plants or private systems, but pushing up to those, to industry, to users of PFAS, those types of requirements to go test and determine. And in fact, we've talked about this, I think, in some other of our webinars and such, but in North Georgia, the carpet industry has a lot of PFAS in it, in their manufacturing process. And what the environmental groups did is they sued, using the citizen provision, the municipality, not because the municipality is going to pay them millions of dollars, but the municipality in this discharge had the PFAS. But what their settlement was, that they would institute a requirement for those industries discharging to them to go sample and find it and then get rid of it, so that they could kind of ban it, if you will, from the municipal wastewater discharge. Because what it does for them, if it doesn't come to them, it doesn't end up in their biosolids. So then the biosolids can end up on the farm. We don't have those issues. So they're using the citizen provision not as a moneymaker, but as a way to help the municipality create the program to go find. And in that case, it was very clear. It was a smaller city. There was, you know, a couple, I think, different carpet manufacturers in town. And they assumed they were the biggest individuals. If you did that, say, along the Houston Ship Channel, where you have all sorts of different industries, both the typical chemical refining and electroplate and consumer business, all sorts of different businesses discharging, that becomes a more difficult issue of figuring out, okay, who's contributing PFAS? And that gets down to, okay, can we start fingerprinting? Can we distinguish between these molecules? Where do they come from? You know, most people have not been able to, you know, make them designer molecules with your name on them. But is there a way, Scott, for us to figure out whose PFAS it was?
Oh, absolutely. As the analysis gets better and better, being able to do the forensics and being able to look at what compounds are coming from what areas. It's interesting, even when you're looking at some of the oxidizer variants that are CFCs and fluorocarbons, by definition, are PFAS. And as they break down, they can break down into other PFAS molecules as well. So you're going to see some real interesting litigation over, especially with CERCLA reopeners and an old Superfund site, whose PFAS was that?
And this gets to an interesting aspect of the PFOA, PFAS listing under CERCLA, is we may go back to the future here, fighting about fingerprinting and allocation. If you had a site that had organic issues and you cleaned it up, and now they're finding PFAS, EPA goes in and samples, and they're starting to do that. The wheels turn slowly at EPA, as I can firmly attest to, but they are sampling. They're going to push PRPs to go in and sample. And when they find it, did the PFAS get there through the same waste pathway that the organics got there, or are they distinguishable? I mean, there are sites where there's an operable unit for waste handling facility at one end of the plant, and then the old slag pile at the other end, maybe a different group of folks. So we may be back to that point where the PRPs are trying to truly create an allocation based on chemicals and fingerprinting, and also because the cleanup technology may in fact be very different. Initially, PFAS, it was thought just everything goes to granulated activated carbon. Well, that also dealt with a lot of organics. So you just throw more carbon at it and life's fine. This is likely going to be a different remediation technology required to deal with it if it's found at these sites than what was installed to deal with the original hazardous substances.
But let's kick the regulators out of the conversation for a minute. I mean, Scott, in your line of work, are you seeing kind of a transition from avoidance of the PFAS issue to active engagement. If we're transitioning from earlier phases where we didn't really know enough about PFAS, or we hadn't taken regulatory action on it yet, or we didn't have technologies to help us address and remediate PFAS, like where are we sort of on that timeline?
It really depends on a company's risk profile and how proactive they're being. And that really goes across the spectrum, even within the same industry. We have clients who are getting ahead of this and being proactive and seeing this as an opportunity to work with the regulators and be seen as a proactive party. We have other clients who are, I know I'm going to have to do something eventually. I just don't know when it's going to be or where it's going to be. So I'm having a hard time committing to that capital or digging into this issue at one site. Why don't necessarily I do it at all sites? So there's a lot of that debate going on in boardrooms and in organizations across the country.
And it sounds like a complicated triage question, right?
It's the classic question, you know, the famous unknown unknowns, or turning them into known unknowns now, PFAS, and then turning it into a known known. I mean, the more you know about a liability, the easier it is to conduct transactions because the risk profile is fairly well known. And part of it is cash flow versus total cost issue. Prior life, I had a river that was going to likely be potentially a $1 billion cleanup. That's a big number for almost all of our clients. There's a few that it might not be huge. But if it's a cash flow that you're going to spend in a river, you don't go get all the dams at the same time. You work your way down. You're only spending $30 million a year. But for as far as the eye can see, well, that's a different financial transaction issue than it is a $1 billion payment due in 6 months. And so part of this is the capital cost of dealing with PFAS come down as these technologies really do come down, then they become manageable. I mean, you have transactions all the time with contaminated property and such. PFAS, we're just at that, still that early learning curve, and you have to look at your transaction dollars. But then it gets back to what we talked about earlier, the definitions. What do you mean by PFAS? What am I looking for? And if you didn't know this particular molecule was present, had no way to measure it, but 5 years from now, you do find it because you can measure it, then what? How do you deal with that with the document you wrote 5 years ago? Is it covered, not covered? Where does it fit? Same thing, you get the same issue with the regulators. If you go back to old air permits of, you know, 30 years ago, you had VOC limits, might have an SO2 limit, a particulate limit. Now you have all sorts of speciated VOCs. And as we started measuring, we found a lot more of different VOCs than perhaps we'd ever disclosed initially. So they'd always been there, but they hadn't been in the permit. And so is that a compliance issue? Is it just, okay, we got better information, we just roll it in and keep moving? Those are some of the issues that regulators are going to have to deal with PFAS. But they can look back to, is not the first time we've had to deal with this, as examples.
Look, we just finally got to the point where there are approved test methods. We finally got to the point where there's a few compounds that are regulated under CERCLA and clean water. How many of them are going to be there? What compounds to clean up to what levels if no one's requiring me to do it or requiring me to treat it? I can understand to an extent why you would not want to go down that pathway because there's so many unknowns. And do you treat a system to non-detect? You treat it to 5 ppt, or is it 50 ppt, or is it 150 ppt? As the science changes, we're going to learn more about these compounds, and I don't think these are going to be static numbers. And with so much unknown right now, I can understand why companies would hesitate, but they're starting to take notice. They're starting to get their arms around the risk. And to Steve's point, especially around due diligence, you want to understand that Superfund legacy liability may have been closed. I'm using bunny ears because we're not on camera. It may not be closed after all.
So, Pope, we're going to leave all this for you to figure out because we're going to watch you solve the PFAS problem for me on the porch playing with my granddaughter. You know, so you've heard this. What do you think of this? You know, you're a little earlier in your career than us. How do you see this going?
I don't know how I see it going. I think I love hearing that, you know, technological help is on the way and that people, really brilliant people, are putting their scientific and engineering know-how into addressing the problem, right? It's I think it's cool to see movement from, and I'm thinking like I should have made my own Halloween costume out of PFAS molecular diagram, right? Like that would be very niche, but maybe should have done that. But anyways, back to your question, it's interesting to think about, okay, well, we have the capability to address some of these issues today, right? For some compounds at certain costs, maybe those costs are going to come down in the future, but we're in a fluid environment and existing standards, cleanup goals, those might change in the future, right? And thinking about how we can price in the costs of sampling and cleanup, and at the same time, try to negotiate the fact that this is all still emerging. It's an interesting challenge for sure. I'm still going to call you on your porch with your granddaughter, though, because I think if I've learned anything from this conversation, it's that, oh, yeah. And I hope our clients take this away, too. Call Stephen and Scott.
So Daniel, I want to put one thing out there. It's not just industry, and I don't want to make industry as a bad guy. I'm from industry. Yeah, they're my client. It's also the government. I have a friend who I'm not going to name, or he won't be my friend anymore, at the Department of Energy. And the government, according to him, believes that PFAS could be the second most significant financial liability the government has behind Social Security when you consider the global impact at military bases, Department of Energy facilities, et cetera. And there's opportunities for the Department of Defense and these government agencies to take a whole of government approach to solve this whole of national problem that's rather ubiquitous. And we still haven't seen, for the exact same reasons, what do we clean up to, at what levels and which compounds? And oh my God, it's so big that everyone's a little bit frozen to take that first step, a fear of having to solve the entire universe. We have this problem of having perfection stand in the way of progress. And I love the Australian approach is, let's at least get started. Okay, that's a horrible Australian accent.
Edit that out. That's fine.
Let's at least make progress here and fix 90% of the problem, and let's worry about the other 10% later. Let's at least get the biggest bang for the buck and stop the exposure in drinking water, and then we can polish the rest later. And it's just, that's a little bit of the frustrating part being on the inside, because the technology is there. Begin to make progress on the biggest pieces of the problem.
Scott, I have to interject. DOE worrying about PFAS and DOD, the portfolio of PFAS in the government is huge, but comparing that to the cleanup from the Cold War and the plutonium and such, and the cost that they're spending at Savannah River and Hanford, it would be interesting. There's a betting pool for you this modern day. Which one's going to be more expensive in cleaning up the Cold War or cleaning up PFAS for the government? I don't know what the answer is going to be for that. My hope is, I think the PFAS will be cheaper because I think the technology is going to get there. I would encourage, particularly the younger lawyers who haven't lived through when PCBs became an issue, mm-hmm. and we went through all that and went through MTB wars. And there's a number of different models to look at that PFAS has some similarities to it. I think we did an earlier webinar or something on that. Go talk to your veteran lawyers. How did they deal that when that came up? Because that'll help generate ideas on this. What's different about this is there, pollution problems, initially you could see them. You could see the river on fire. You saw the sheen on the water. You could smell it, the smog. We've gone to there to where we had, part per million problems. Then there were some part per billion problems. Now we're at a part per trillion and / quadrillion, which is another whole new ball game. And so there's probably going to need to be some different approaches because of that. But you can learn from the history. So there's value in understanding how do you deal with a permit where you know you're going to do testing and you're likely to find stuff that's not in your permit. How do you work with that? Do you proactively go get a permit provision that says, this is what you're going to do. We're going to find it, do this test. Then we'll come back to you, agency, mm-hmm. with, here's what I found. Here's what's there. Here's what I can do with it. And then rewrite the permit. That's something that is more prevalent in Europe and other parts of the world in their approach to permitting. The U.S. tends to, you've got to pick the number before you ever build it and hope you can get it right. But we may need a different approach than that. PFAS, that the initial approach is, look, let's go measure. Let's see what's there. And then we figure out, where's the technology? What's doable? What's practical? And then evolve over time as the technology improves, the methods improve and such. So there's some things to learn from history. They're not all the answers aren't there, but they may be the generation of ideas come from those discussions with those who have kind of been through this before with other molecules.
Well, I do know we're going to have to circle up in a few years to see what the state of technology is. Scott, we'll try to check in with you long before that. It's always a pleasure to visit with you and hear your insights and the perspective you bring as a non-lawyer. And we're all stuck in our legal world with the Code of Federal Regulations.
Did you notice he gave like three different legal answers? It depends.
He's dangerous.
His initial answer to almost every question was, it depends. So he's been hanging around as lawyers long enough now.
That's right.
He's almost an honorary member.
That's right. Well, we're glad to have him in the family. He would certainly increase the dignity of our profession dramatically should he ever join
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
But thank you both for talking about PFAS, getting practical with it, thinking about where this is headed, talking a little bit about the technologies that companies can start to consider as they make those decisions about what to price in, what next steps to take, what next steps can we take, what should we take? Those are all complicated questions. And so it's great to spend time with two gentlemen who have thought a lot about those same questions and have some thoughts to share. Thank you both.
That's it for us today at the Environmental Law Monitor. Big thanks to our guests, as well as Dorn, Emily, and the rest of our production team who helped to make this episode possible. And of course, thank you, our listeners, and we'll talk to you soon.